Hello, everyone, and welcome to minute 46 of season 10 of Movie Around Minute, the daily podcast where we hijack our way through the 1974 action thriller, The Taking of Pelham 123, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me this week is Dave Anderson of Free Kittens Movie Guide. Welcome to the show, Dave.
Thank you, Rob, for having me. I'm looking forward to talking about this one. It's number 9 on my all-time great list, so.
Oh, wow, number 9. That's pretty good.
Number 9.
Okay, so you got me curious. I'm gonna have to ask you for the full rundown. What's your top 10?
Okay, my top 10 in order is.
There you go.
Jaws. Number 1.
Oh, you started with number 1.
Jaws.
Okay.
I can go back backwards if you.
That's fine. Now I know why you're good friends with Richard.
Okay. 2 is Pulp Fiction. 3 is The Godfather Parts 1 and 2. I consider them two parts of the same story.
Okay.
4 is North by Northwest. 5 is Sorcerer, the remake of Wages of Fear.
Yeah.
6 is Goodfellas. 7 is The Original Exorcist. 8 is Forbidden Planet. 9 is The Taking of Pelham 123. And 10 is Bad Day at Black Rock.
Interesting. Okay, that's a very interesting top 10. Now, if you were to put all 3 Godfathers together, would that drag it down, or would it keep it at the same number?
It might drag it down a little bit. I don't really I like The Godfather 3 more than some people. I consider it kind of a, well, like Francis Ford Coppola said, kind of a coda to the original story. But it isn't necessary. So I don't, it might drag down the trilogy a little bit, but not significantly, I don't think.
Okay.
There's still a lot to like about that. What's your top 10?
Oh, I couldn't even give you a top 10. I have so many movies that are close. I've never, I think I have like 150 movies that I rate, 10 out of 10, 5 out of 5, however you want to look at it. I've never tried to move them around and say which one I like the best. But I'm assuming that very high on my list will be Die Hard, the original Star Wars, probably also Empire and Jedi. Those three will all go together there. Saving Private Ryan is definitely up there also. The Taking of Pelham 123.
What was that one?
Saving Private Ryan.
Okay.
Okay. The Great Escape. I mean, again, these are all movies that I've now done movies by minute also. So that's sort of a window into, not the Star Wars movies, obviously, but it's a window into my favorite movies, everything. Because I've done Die Hard and I did all 5 of them, actually. Saving Private Ryan, I did The Great Escape. The Taking of Pelham 123 is a movie that I've always loved. But it probably wouldn't break into my top 50 because I probably have more movies that are up there. But I wanted something different for the season. And because it's a movie that I love, I said, all right, I'm going to do it now as opposed to holding it off. Because a lot of my favorite movies have already been done movies by minute. Like Back to the Future probably would be very high up there also. The Indiana Jones trilogy, I'm not a fan of 4 or 5. I'm not the biggest fan of 4 or 5. So for me, it's still a trilogy. That would also be very high, but those have all been done. So, it's just a question of trying to find movies there. So I don't have a definitive 10 from that perspective. I think it would be really difficult for me to make a definitive 10. But like I said, I have like a definitive 150. But then again,
I have a definitive 100.
Okay. I do have no, but you have a definitive 100 in order. I don't. That's my point.
Oh.
Gotcha. I do have a movie review website that has 13,000 reviews on it. So I've seen a few movies. So, I've really been looking forward to discussing the Taking of Pelham 123 with you because I know that was you were the one who put it in as the movie of the month a few years ago. In the Lambcast, and I know that you weren't able to even make it for that particular episode. So No one got to hear what you think about it. So now people will have that opportunity to hear what you think of the movie. Do you remember the first time that you've seen this movie?
Yeah, I was a kid and I saw it on television. And so I saw it, as things were in the 70s, edited for television. But, it intrigued me enough to go ahead and read the book as well, which is decidedly different than the movie
Yes.
is.
But since Garber's not
I
a very
didn't.
big character in it.
No. And I didn't actually see it in its original R-rated form and probably till the mid-80s. And that's when I truly began to love that film.
Okay, I
Was
mean, I don't think there's that much that they cut out that they would have cut out. I mean, there's a little bit of swearing here and there, but
Yeah, but that swearing is part of the, I don't know, the New York vernacular that
you're talking about all the
to me.
goddamn and goddamn and goddamn. That stuff was that's right. Back in the 70s, they cut all that out. Now it's not like nowadays where that wouldn't be edited anywhere. You're right. I keep forgetting about that. I mean, I am a child of the 80s, so I'm very familiar with the way that they would edit movies and dub them. The famous one is the Police Academy dub. Where he says, "Drop that gosh darn radio before I." Hey, it's something like, "Drop that radio before I blow your gosh darn knees off, egg roll." Instead of him saying, "Drop that radio before I blow your goddamn nuts off, asshole." So,
It doesn't quite have the same impact.
no.
And back in the 70s, they didn't just cut it for language and violence and stuff. They would compress it for time. And so everything would be interrupted by Calgon commercials. And but also back then, if you didn't see it in a theater, or see it at home, on network television, you didn't see it. There was
That's
no
right.
home video at that.
That's right.
So.
Unless you were connected to, was it Channel Z? I think that's what it was called. I think that's what it was called. Which there's a great documentary about that, about Channel. I think it's called Channel Z, right?
I
Where
think so, yeah.
it was like the unofficial pre-cable channel that people in the LA area were able to get to see movies all the time.
Yeah, and also at the time, you were able to get HBO. I remember it costing a lot of money, and my parents got it for a while. We were the only people in the neighborhood who had it, and they would come in and they'd stick this huge phallic antenna on top of your roof, and you would get HBO beamed to your house. This is before, anyone really had cable. That was pretty amazing at the time, too.
Right. I mean, we got HBO in 1982, but it came out in 72. So that was 10 years later. I remember the month that we got HBO, Star Wars was the one of the movies that was first being shown. And I
Nice.
must have seen it so many times that particular month. Because you could. It was free.
And that's back when HBO still showed primarily just movies.
That's right. That's right. And it was also right at the beginning of when HBO started making their own movies. I remember there were a few, like they would have like one a month, like a made for HBO movie that were always like interesting to try to catch. And obviously you got to talk about, if we're going to talk about HBO, you got to talk about the HBO opening theme,
Oh, yeah.
with that goes through the city and all that stuff, which is really, really cool. I actually rewatched it a few years. There was a documentary about it that I found on YouTube, and I actually reviewed it because
Really?
it was so nostalgic for me just to think about it and rewatch it and see how the whole thing was put together. And it was a very cool idea. Okay, but we're actually here to talk about Thinkin' Film 1-2-3, not HBO, but
Sorry.
that's still fun. No, not at all. I love going on a fun tangent. There's no problem with that.
Okay.
And so since it is so high on your list, can you guesstimate how many times you've probably seen it, or do you know?
I've probably watched it about once every 2 years since
Okay. Okay, so you've seen
since
it
I got it
25,
on video.
25, 30 times, something like that. That's pretty good.
Probably,
Okay.
yeah.
Yeah. I haven't seen it that many times. I've probably seen it about 15 times. That's where I would gauge. I mean, my story, I've told it before, but it's a very simple story. One of my older brothers would come with his friends, and they'd like have a random video that they random 70s video that they wanted to watch. This was like the mid 80s. And so because I was a movie fan, I would sit and watch whatever they were watching. And they once brought The Longest Yard, so that was the first time I saw that. And then they brought this one, and I'm like, what the hell is a Pelham? And they're like, oh, just watch it, just watch it. And I've loved the movie ever since.
Yeah.
It just enthralled me from the first time watching it. Every time I watch it, I enjoy it more and more because I notice more things that I hadn't thought about beforehand.
For
That type
sure,
of thing.
yeah.
So yeah, have you seen either or both of the remakes?
I've seen both the remakes. There was one that was made for television. I think it had Vincent D'Onofrio in the Mr.
Yeah.
Blue role.
That's right.
And
With
it
Edward
was
James
really,
Olmos in the Garber type of role, because he has a
yeah.
different name in that movie.
I remember it being pretty lethargic.
Yeah, it was.
The ones with Denzel Washington and John Travolta. I'm not one of those people who thinks most movies are such a sacred cow that a remake is out of the question. And I did like the fact that they didn't just simply do a scene for scene remake of that film. I don't think it's a great movie, but it is watchable. I don't really, I'm partial to the old one, of course, but the remake isn't without its merits. Anything with Denzel is worth watching. I did find Travolta's take on Mr. Blue pretty obnoxious.
Yes. I mean, one of the few things that I like about the remake, and I don't like it in general, is the fact that they use the real names of the characters from the novel. So, Travolta's name is Ryder.
That's right, yeah.
And Denzel, they called him Walter Garber there, but and he's a train master as opposed to being the cop. And I didn't like that aspect of it because, I love the way that Walter Matthau plays this character. He makes this movie so enjoyable to watch.
And you learn everything you need to know about his character just by Matthau's performance. You don't He doesn't need any background, he doesn't need a past. He doesn't need any side story about something that happened to him or anything like that.
That's
It's a
right. That he
it's
once accidentally shot someone, and that's why he now is, exactly.
right.
Right. Okay. So minute 46 begins with Green making an assumption and ends with Green continuing his tale. So we left things off on Friday with Green and Blue having a little bit of a conversation about what's going to happen if they don't agree to pay the ransom. And Blue said, well, lots of people are going to die. And this minute opens up with Green saying, well, including us. So, it's first of all, it's a great cut between that everyone had to wait the weekend to find for us to start talking about it. But I've always liked Green as a character because he's completely a fish out of water here. It's not what you
Yeah.
expect. When you watch when you see a movie about a heist, there you have certain expectations about the various characters. And in this movie, you don't have that about Mr. Green because he's so very different.
I would agree with that.
He's not your typical train hijacker, I guess you can say. For lack of a better phrase. And it works because of it. Because on the one hand, you can sort of feel for him. Sorry, there are moments that you can feel for him, and there are moments that you're like, okay, there is something wrong with this guy. he
Sure.
does And I mean, this minute we're gonna actually even come across some of that, some of those aspects of it. But he's one of the few characters, you know, you mentioned before that we don't know much about Garber, and we don't need to know much about Garber. But Green is actually one of the characters who they tell us enough about as the story moves along. You know, like for instance, Gray and Brown, we find out little things about them all the way at the end. We don't know much about them, and Blue also the same type of thing. There are bits and pieces. I mean, even in today's minute, we'll get a little bit about that, but in general, we don't know much about them, and it's fine that we don't. You know, we don't need to know about any of these guys' backgrounds. We know these guys are hijackers. That's what it comes down to. Now, here's a question that I've asked all of my guests so far, and I'm wondering what your take is on it. Do you think that Mr. Blue thought up this whole heist himself, or are they basically, you know, similar to Reservoir Dogs, which obviously there are connections between Reservoir Dogs and this movie, that, you know, there's a money guy in the back that, you know, thought of the idea, thought of the plan, and he has hired Blue to be the lead man to take care of this heist.
I never got that impression. I got the impression that Mr. Blue was the ringleader who masterminded all of it. And as you were going to talk about, in this upcoming minute, his reasons for doing so, even though he doesn't necessarily state it out loud. Yeah, I think this is all Blue's doing. I don't think there's anyone else behind it besides him. And he's the one who picked these people to help him pull it off.
Okay. Again, that's a fair assumption. We have no way of knowing the truth here. You know, it could go either way. I mean, I lean towards the fact that this is not something that Blue has completely put together on his own. But you know, the basis of that assumption is the fact that I don't know how he would have necessarily gotten in touch with someone like Green. And I think that he would have possibly even smarter before picking Mr. Gray.
Yeah,
You
that's a
know,
couple of
those
questions that I want to ask when we start talking about this minute.
are right. Okay. All right. So let's just jump into the minute. So, you know, as I said, Green realizes that you know, there are a lot of people that are going to die, and it could be us. And then Blue says something very strange that, again, is possibly what you're referring to. He goes, "Well, it's better than selling life insurance, isn't it?" And Green goes, "Life insurance? You told me you were in the army." He goes, "I was. That's where I developed my expensive tastes." He goes, "Ah, British Army, $150 a month." He goes, "You got to be kidding." He goes, "The Africans paid me $5,000 a month for leading a battalion." Jesus. He goes, "What the hell did you get that out of that for? What the hell did you get out of that for?" And he goes, "Because the market dried up." Wow. So it's a very interesting conversation that's going on here with the two of them. That the life insurance thing it always throws me for a curve. You know, because it I can't see Mr. Blue going and selling life insurance. He doesn't seem
Life
like that.
insurance to protect from him, maybe.
Maybe. Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, it would seem as if it would be more of a scam.
Yeah, probably. I think, when I was putting together my notes for this, I started to think about this particular scene and, its importance to the narrative. And it turns out it's really important. You talked about how we get to know a little bit about how Mr. Green ended up there, but it's pretty much the extent of everything we know about Mr. Blue as well.
That's right.
And in terms of character development, I think it's crucial. The dichotomy between Blue's cold detachment of the seasoned pro and, Green as the fish out of water, like you said, in over his head, I think is an excellent contrast. And we
And they
learn
get
everything
along
we need to
so
know about
well.
him.
And you know, the
I get the imp
camaraderie between these two guys, they seem like old friends.
Yeah, I get the impression that this is the only person in the crew that Mr. Blue actually likes and
Yes.
trusts.
Well, I don't know. I think he does trust Mr. Brown. He makes a comment about it. I'm trying to remember when it was. Maybe it was already 2 weeks ago, or maybe it's coming up, where he does say something that I don't trust Gray, but I trust Brown. He does make a comment about
That's
that.
right, yeah.
So it's
I
possible
think
that Brown
sometimes.
is. I mean, obviously he's never done any heists before with Gray or Green, but maybe he did something with Brown in the past.
That's entirely possible. I also, and Mr. Blue in this one also seems a little bit sympathetic towards Mr. Green. He doesn't necessarily believe Green's story about how he was set up.
All right. We'll get to that shortly, right?
Okay, sorry.
No, that's okay. That's not a problem.
I am curious, like you said earlier, how these two managed to hook up.
Correct.
It's an intriguing mystery the film chooses not to answer. I mean, narratively, I guess it doesn't really matter, but I can't really remember if the novel goes into that or not. I don't recall that, but if
I
the
recall something about the two of them having talked in a pub or something like that. It's been a while since I've read the novel, but for some reason I have that in the back of my mind, even though it might not be true.
Yeah, it's been at least 40 or 50, 40 years since I've read it too, and but it seems plausible. Obviously, Mr. Blue was looking for someone he needed to pull this off, so he probably was scoping out quite a few motormen before
Right.
settling on Mr. Green, I would think.
No, but then again, the question is it makes it seem as if Mr. Green is the one who has the idea for how to beat the dead man switch. And then you see
Oh,
that's one of
absolutely.
the reasons, that's another reason why I think that there's someone behind this whole thing. Because Mr. Blue wouldn't have thought of that idea himself. He would have had to have gotten it from somebody who's more connected to the trains.
That does make
I don't
sense.
know. I mean, maybe the two of them were sitting in they were both sitting in a bar, and Blue happened to overhear Green say to somebody else, "Well, I want to get back at that transit authority, and I know how to beat their whole idea of a dead man switch or something like that." And then light bulb went off by Blue, and he goes, "Hey, I can help you with that."
It's an interesting theory.
But again, I have nothing to back up that theory. But then again, that's why we do it this we do this to try to think of interesting theories about the way that these things work and play out, and stuff like that. Okay, so he mentions Mr. Green mentions the fact that he must be getting paid $150 a month. How much do you think $150 from 1974 is worth today, obviously taking into account inflation?
I still don't think it was a hell of a lot. Probably a living wage, I would say. It might be the equivalent to, I don't know, $3,000 today.
Okay, it's the equivalent of $986, so it's about
Oh,
$1,000.
well, that's why I was never a math teacher. So.
Okay, no, that's fine. I didn't do the math on my own. That's what the internet is for.
$900 for selling insurance?
No,
Wow.
$1,000. No. It was $1,000 for he says for working in the British Army. This is what Green says. Green says,
Oh, that's
"Ah,
right.
British
You're
Army,
right. You're right.
$150 a month." So he's assuming that the British Army pays $1,000 a month. That type of thing.
Okay.
So then the next question I have is, okay, then he mentions that he got paid $5,000 by the Africans per month. So what would the $5,000 a month be today?
I would have to think it would be, I don't know, 20,000
$32,857.
a month. That's
Yes,
pretty
that's
respectable
amazing.
living.
Yes, completely. Yeah, that's
I wouldn't give up that gig either.
I don't know. You want to be a mercenary in Africa? I don't know.
Well, in the fantasy world, yes. In the real world,
Okay.
I'd probably piss myself, so.
Maybe. It's interesting that he says the market dried up. I guess they didn't need much for Soldiers of Fortune in the early 70s.
I imagine
They needed
that's,
them in the 60s, and that's it.
and I would imagine, and I'm guessing, of course, because I know nothing about mercenaries, but I imagine it is one of those occupations where some months you're making a lot of money and others you're not because you're freelancing. So.
You'd think that with everything that was going on in the 70s, he would have moved to like South America or something like that, where there he can get paid also, that type of thing. But they needed him in New York in order to be able to hijack a train. So, that's where he ended up.
If he was hired to do that, yeah.
Correct. And then at this point, Green says to him, "Wow, $5,000. Well, at least you weren't fired." And then he mutters to himself, "I don't give a shit. Who the hell wants to drive a subway train for the rest of his life?" And Blue just gives him a look. And again, this is a great look because, he's just commiserating with himself. Blue didn't ask him anything about his job at that point. And once he starts muttering like that, so then Blue does get into it and goes, "Well, what'd they catch you doing?" And Green looks at him and goes, "Nothing." He said, "What do you mean? They framed me. The Biggies needed a fall guy." He goes, "Biggies? Transit cops, undercover guys. They got wind of a gang passing dope, transporting from downtown to uptown, and giving it to a motorman, and somebody picking it up in Harlem." So again, he's very defensive here. I don't believe him for a second that he was innocent.
I don't think, yeah, Mr. Blue does either. Mr. Blue sounds like
Yes.
he's heard this story before.
Yes. He's like, "All right, yeah, sure. You didn't do it." It reminds me of Shawshank, where everyone's innocent in here.
Absolutely.
You a go lawyer f me. It's like
Robert Shaw's so good in this one. Like
Yes.
your type, the expressions he gives says so much about his personality, that he's, cynical. He's seen it all before. He's emotionally detached. Yet just a little bit of sympathy you can see in his slight smile in his eyes towards Mr. Green, even though Mr. Green probably made his own nest.
That's right. True. And that's how this minute ends. With Mr. Green just trying to give up some information, but what I wrote in my notes is lies, lies, and more lies. That's
For sure.
more or less what it sounds like, and it makes me wonder if Mr. Blue was also telling the truth about life insurance. It could be that he's making that up also, because again, I can't see him doing a respectable job like that.
I can't even see him getting a job like that.
That's right. Maybe he killed someone in order to get the job, but that would be my guess about
Considering how, Mr. Blue plays everything close to the vest, it's kind of interesting how he reveals anything about himself to Mr. Green.
That's right.
So I don't get the impression that he would be making any of it up.
Well, the truth is, I think he is making it up from the perspective that he doesn't want to give any personal information.
Yeah. That's possible, sure.
On the one hand, he trusts Mr. Green, but to an extent, there's no question in my mind if it's between Green and Blue is going to kill Green.
For sure.
Green isn't going to know how to kill Blue or any of the others. Green doesn't fire a single shot throughout the whole movie, and he's just, carrying the gun. That's it. Yeah. Did you have anything else to say about this particular minute?
I think the only thing I want to add is I think what this film does almost as well as Jaws is it takes its source material and just boils it down to its essential elements and gets rid of all that other baggage. And that's what I like most about that scene, because the original book did, go into the backgrounds of each of the hijackers,
Not just
which
the
makes
hijackers, it went
interesting.
into all the characters. It went into some characters that, they told us all about Kaz Dalowitz's history,
Yeah, it repeatedly
which we
switches.
don't need.
Yeah, it repeatedly switches points of view, and which works to an extent in a book, but in a movie, just boil it down to its essentials, and this is a good example of that. It's all we need to know about these two characters to make him sympathetic or the opposite.
Okay, that makes sense. I wonder if in the novel it mentions anything about life insurance.
About what?
About life insurance. No, the life insurance is not in the novel at all. I
Okay.
just did a quick check. So again, this is something that they added. Oh yeah, no. Okay, so the conversation is actually very interesting between the two of them in the novel. This is actually a conversation that happens before the whole thing, which again is how the two of them I guess sort of became friends and stuff like that. And he does talk about him that he was in the Congo and in Bolivia, and then Green goes, "You're a soldier of fortune?" And he goes, "That's a fancy name for it. Mercenary is more accurate. Meaning someone who fights for money?" "Yes." "Well, I'm sure the money was secondary to the adventure." And he goes, "They were paying me $2,500 a month to lead a battalion. I wouldn't have touched it for a penny less." And he goes, "Biafra? The Congo? Bolivia? Bolivia, isn't that where Che Guevara was? You weren't on his." "No, I was with the other people, the side that killed him. Didn't actually think you were a commie. I'm whatever I'm paid to be." "Sure as hell sounds like an exciting and glamorous life. What made you quit it?" He goes, "The market dried up, no job opportunities, and no unemployment insurance." And then he goes, "How does a guy get into work like that?" And then Blue doesn't respond and says to him, "Well, how did you get into driving a subway train?" So yeah, it's funny how he says that there's no unemployment insurance, but he doesn't say anything about maybe when they made the actual transition to writing the script, they misread the line with insurance and said, "Oh, he must have worked in insurance," instead of saying he needed unemployment insurance.
That's
I
entirely
don't
possible.
know. All right. So every Monday we have a segment called Mathow Monday, where my guests will give their top five Walter Matthau performances. So, Dave, why don't you start with your number five and work your way up?
Okay, my number five is the Bad News Bears. I saw this when I was a kid. I kind of like looking at his Morris Buttermaker character as an extension of Oscar Madison.
Okay, fair enough.
And Matthau pretty much stuck to comedy roles from here on out after that one. But I remember just loving this when I was a kid because it was a movie featuring kids and they were swearing and doing all this questionable stuff. And it was still a feel good sports movie, and the classical music score just said it perfectly. Hasn't aged quite as well, I suppose, in this more enlightened era, but Matthau's terrific in it. My number
Yes,
four,
I
speaking
agree.
of Oscar Madison, would be The Odd Couple. I always liked it when he worked with Jack Lemmon, and Oscar was kind of an inspiration to me as a kid, maybe more from the TV show that Jack Klugman did with it. With the same character. But I did go back and watch the movie after falling in love with the TV show, and I found it just as enjoyable. Some of it went over my head when I was a child because there was no laugh track to tell me it was funny, but I revisited that one not too long ago, and it really holds up pretty well. Third would be his performance in Pelham 1-2-3. Enough said about that. He just has this world weariness to him that fits the character. My number two, this is a movie called Charlie Varrick.
Yeah, of course.
Criminally underseen and forgotten thriller with Matthau as the leader of a crew who robs a bank where mafia money is being laundered. I actually didn't discover this one until just a couple of years ago. I'd been doing some reading about it and was talking with someone else about the film. And so I went ahead and bought the Blu-ray sight unseen and just thought it was terrific. And this is one of the few times where, I'm watching Walter Matthau and he's actually really cool in this one. And cool isn't something usually attached to an actor like Walter Matthau. But
No, not at all.
he's a smooth criminal in this one. And it's a smart story. It's got a good supporting cast. I've probably watched it three or four times since I bought the Blu-ray a few years ago. I just really enjoy that one.
Oh, well, I actually just rewatched it last week because I hadn't seen it in over a decade, and I liked it a lot more now than beforehand. The one thing that kept getting me is that there's too many love scenes for Walter Matthau, and it just doesn't it doesn't fit in. But when you know the trivia that the actress who plays, I guess you can sort of say his love interest, is Jack Lemmon's wife. So basically, he got the screw over Jack Lemmon's wife in that movie.
I wonder what Jack thought about that.
The paycheck.
And number one on my list is Failsafe. This is also on my top 100 list. He plays the de facto antagonist in this one, the guy who forecasts possible nuclear war scenarios. And he displays a cold-bloodedness that it's you really hate this guy from the get-go. He's almost a warmonger in this without being part of the military. It's a pretty chilling performance.
Yeah, I would agree with that assessment of it.
So that.
And again, it doesn't feel like the type of character that Walter Matthau normally would play, which is why it's interesting to watch.
Probably this before, I mean, he wasn't as widely known then. I mean, he was still making a name for himself and he was still, people knew who he was, but he didn't have that Matthau persona that
Correct.
where he was mostly associated with comedy.
Okay, that is a great list. Thank you very much for that. All right, so now we will play our daily game of Name That Remake, where I will randomly give you a few hints about a movie that was remade. I will tell you the years the year that the original came out, the year that the remake was made, and a brief synopsis that hopefully won't give it away too easily. So let's spin the wheel and see what random movie you get to try to guess. Spin the wheel and original came out in 1954, and the remake was made in 1995. Okay, it's about two brothers who both form a crush on the daughter of one of the workers in their mansion.
Is it Sabrina?
Yes, it is. Very good.
Look at me.
That's right. So the original from 1954 with Humphrey Bogart, William Holden, and Audrey Hepburn. And the remake from 1995 with Harrison Ford, Julia Ormond, and Greg Kinnear. I'm much more of a fan of the original than the remake, even though I love the actors in the remake. I just don't think that the remake is as enjoyable, I
It's a
guess you can say.
respectable remake, but I agree with you. It doesn't stand out like the original.
All right, excellent. So, Dave, would you like to tell people where they can find you?
You can find me at freekittensmovieguide.com, where we're keeping physical media alive through reviews, and I also write a lot of retrospective essays about films from the past.
All right. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Around Minute. You can find me on Facebook, you can find me on Twitter, you can find me on Instagram. You can find me on my website, movieroundminute.com. And if you want to send me an email, you can send it to movieroundminute@movierob.net. So until tomorrow, achoo!
Good night.